Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday morning at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about taste. People ask why taste, and all I can really think of to say is because taste matters. And one of the ways taste matters is because it sort of informs our daily experience and enriches our lives. And also because through taste, I think that we can understand a lot about ourselves, and also why shouldn't things taste good? And today we have an interesting conversation, one I've been looking forward to, because we're going to be talking about taste in a different context and food in a different context, really. That is public food, street food, the idea of an urban experience that's enriched by food vendors and public eating in a very particular way. And I'm very pleased to welcome today's guests, Melina Shannon DiPietro, who's the director of Highline Food and Revenue. The Highline, for those of you who don't know, is an amazing new urban park that we'll hear a lot more from Melina about. Thank you for joining us, Melina. And also with us today is David Weber, who, among other things, is the president of the New York City Food Truck Association, but he's also a co-founder of Rickshaw Dumpling Bar, one of our favorite trucks to spot in my neighborhood where our offices are on 18th Street. Thank you for joining us, David and Melina.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about, first about what you both do. Melina, why don't you talk about the Highline and how food fits into it? Describe it for our listeners who may not be from New York or who are in New York and haven't been there yet, although they have no excuse for that.
Sure.
And talk about the food program that you're responsible for.
Absolutely. So the Highline is a New York City park. It's a great public space. And our co-founders, Joshua David and Robert Hammond, first met at a community board where the agenda topic was the demolition of this elevated rail structure. And they brought together community members, developers, and the city to save the structure. Today, this 1.5 elevated park actually spans three neighborhoods.
1.5 miles?
1.5 yeah. miles, okay. And is on track to have about 3 million visitors annually. So
that's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. Friends of the Highline is the nonprofit that raises about 90% of the operating funds and maintains and operates the Highline. Food fits into this picture in part because there are so many visitors, and they've been asking for food on the Highline.
And what sort of so physically the structure is this long raised train track, basically, that weaves its way through different neighborhoods and even through some buildings, and what sort of food, I mean, when the place was conceived, which is already a leap of understanding that this could be a park in some way, like, what sort of food were we talking about? What sort of food did they have in mind? Why did they bring you? What did they ask you to do?
Well, it was a huge leap of faith to build the park. It's a beautiful park in the sky. And when we began thinking about food on the Highline, the context is important here. So most people think of the Highline as an elevated subway, but it was actually an elevated freight rail.
Right.
And it was a freight rail that brought food into Manhattan.
Interesting.
The question that was facing city planners then in the 1920s, 1930s was, how do we feed a city in a way that's healthy, safe, and cost efficient? Not so unlike the questions that face us as a city today. So when we thought about food on the Highline, we wanted it to be innovative and interesting. We wanted also to keep that historical context in mind. So
right.
as we've brought a variety of food vendors to work with us and bring great food and snacks to the Highline, we've asked them to source from New York State and from regional farms. So today, if you know, a listener to the show visited the Highline this weekend and walked the Highline at 15th Street, they would find Melt Bakery selling amazing apple fritters. The apples in those fried fritters are from Red Jacket Orchard. They would also find Fanny Gerson from La Newyorkina, who has a little Mexican candy shop on the Highline. I love what Fanny does. It's a combination of her immigrant heritage and New York State ingredients. So she's got milk from Ronnybrook Farms, and then she has incredible chocolate and cinnamon from a woman who's hand grinding this in her home state from Mexico.
Wow. Okay. So David, Melina's responsible for food sort of 12 feet above the street, but you both represent vendors on the street and are a vendor yourself. Tell us a little bit about that experience and that, the sort of recent history of that in New York.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the New York City Food Truck Association is an association of small businesses that own and operate premium food trucks in New York City, and we're focused on innovation in hospitality, food, and community development.
So first off, what's a premium food truck? I mean, that makes me think of premium beer or something.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that has really changed in the past, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years, has been the rise of the branded food truck. And I don't know a better sort of way to package that yet than that. But what you see is a break from the relatively undifferentiated food that's been on the street historically in New York, New York City, of hot dog carts, soft serve ice cream, nuts and pretzels, into this blossoming, growing industry where you can get all sorts of specialty items, including schnitzel, dumplings, lobster rolls, artisan ice creams, and you know. There's, you know, the innovation and talent that you used to see just in restaurants in New York City is, you know, moving out into the streets and is becoming more accessible broadly by the New York public.
So one thing I want to ask, and that is, was that the pretzels and the were those traditional street foods ever good? I mean, I ask that from a gastronomic standpoint, because you want them to be good, and they smell good sometimes, and they just have never in my lifetime, my 22 years in New York, ever tasted good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what happened, because I know that street food, you know, in the 20s was an extremely important part of the gastronomic ecosystem. You know, it was an important part of distributing fresh food and vegetables was through these street peddlers. And there's been, you know, political pressure throughout time to ghettoize them, put them into, you know, shared markets, which is where we get the Essex Street Market and the La Marqueta. But I guess recently, maybe in the 50s, it just became the easiest economic system to have sort of mass-produced food coming to the streets. It's just easier to manage one item pretzels or one item hot dogs. And you see all these weird sort of concessions in the law for these types of vendors. So there's four different types of operations you can run with a permit in New York City. You can run a processing cart or a non-processing cart, a processing truck or a non-processing truck. And the difference between processing and non-processing is if you're preparing food.
Right.
And usually non-processing is something prepackaged, like an ice cream novelty. But for some reason, there is a concession that hot dogs are somehow non-processed.
Right.
So they don't need hand wash facilities and other niceties, I guess, which you would ordinarily think are important for public health. So it's a strange sort of historical development of all these layers of law that have led us to where we are today.
Sure. Let me remind our listeners that you can call in and ask us questions about street food, about the High Line, about where you want to get lunch, where the cart is that you want to have lunch today is. And you can dial in at 718-497-2128. You can also write in questions to our email address, info@heritageradionetwork.com. I'm talking to David Weber, the president of the New York City Food Truck Association and a co-founder of Rickshaw Dumpling Bar, Dumpling Trucks, Dumplings, and Melina Shannon DiPietro, who is the director of the Food on the High Line, a fascinating public park 12, 14, 16 feet above.
25 feet.
25? Wow.
It's up there.
It's up there. Well, that's good. I guess all the trucks won't hit it when they drive by. One of the things that's amazing to me about the High Line, I was skeptical when the first projects, I don't know, was it 20 years ago when the idea started, 18 years ago, something? Like, you just thought it would never happen, and then you thought, oh, why is it going to happen? And then you think, oh, my God, all that money. And then you take your first step on the High Line, and it changes your whole perspective on the city. Like, you cross 14th Street, and suddenly you're in a... It's an amazing mind-altering perspective to this place that we all know so well in our sort of nose-to-the-grindstone or nose-to-the-sidewalk existence. And so part of me wonders, how do you build something that feels natural with food? I mean, from your own perspective, how do you put food into this otherworldly experience, but still make it accessible and not make it yuppified and not make, you know, this is a city public park. It's not a fancy restaurant. It's not another type of food experience that we might anticipate. I mean, do you have any thoughts about that?
Absolutely. It's a huge challenge. And, you know, we went to the community. The High Line itself was driven and created by a lot of input from the community. And so one of the first things we did was go to the community and ask for input.
And the community is the neighborhoods or Manhattan or everyone, anyone?
We've got a huge community. It is all those people.
So I see a stack of community things, I think.
That's right. I have a stack of cards, comment cards that community members, so here it's visitors to the High Line, our neighbors in the three different neighborhoods that we span.
And could you name them just so people know what we're talking about?
Yeah, so we're in the Meatpacking District, Lower Chelsea and Upper Chelsea. Those are the three neighborhoods. Very different neighborhoods, huge diversity, both in terms of the type of residences or businesses in the space. But it was, I think the neighbors helped guide us in the right direction. They gave us input on everything from make sure the food's not yuppie to keeping it affordable. We want the experience of food on the High Line to help preserve some of the magic and transcendence of that experience.
Great. Well, I certainly, you know, historically you mentioned, David, where street food comes from, and there are, we've all seen images, or I've seen images anyway, of New York, the Lower East Side, and at the turn of the last century, and street peddlers, and in fact, some of our family, you know, I'm sure Jewish immigrants to New York were involved in that business. Is this new wave part of the fabric in that way? Are we talking about, you know, people from our neighborhood here in Bushwick who might have just discovered how to make a schnitzel, for instance? Or is there still this process of integration into the city, a first business idea? Does every street vendor one day want to have a brick and mortar restaurant and a chain of McDonald's like places? Can you talk a little bit about the aspirations?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a pretty wide mix within the demographic. We have 30 members in the Food Truck Association right now that own and operate 45 vehicles on the streets of Manhattan. And there's a very wide mix in the makeup of the entrepreneurs that are getting into this business. The one thing that everyone has in common is a passion for food and the specific food that they're vending. And usually it's a family recipe or a childhood experience, something that's really makes them love whatever they're selling, be it waffles or schnitzel or coffee or ice cream. I would say that about half of these entrepreneurs are immigrants or recent immigrants. And, you know, some of them are former professionals. Some of them grew up on the streets vending and had their vehicle or their permits passed down to them through their family. So everyone's really aspiring to do something more. About 30% of our members are either own and operate a brick and mortar establishment in addition to their food truck or aspire to do so. And so what you see is many people that get a foothold like Souvlaki GR with their food truck and then open their restaurant in the Lower East Side, or MexiQ, which opened a food truck and then found the funding to open their restaurants. And we were just speaking earlier about the Kimchi Taco Truck, who is in the process of opening a restaurant as well.
So, well, we're going to take a break and we'll come back in a minute, but I want to pick up this idea and this tension that sometimes exists, certainly in the municipal politics between bricks and mortar folks and property taxes and that stuff. And I know the territorial fights for street vendors in corners and important places for them to do business. And there's a loud knocking noise in where we are, and that will go away. So we'll be right back.
I don't know much when I knew less, and I was heartbroken for the first time. I was drowning in my tears, and I went looking for a lifeline. I was trying to find some comfort, just a simple tender touch, searching for some little cure that would not cost too much. And I could hear that produce wagon on the street, and I could hear that farmer singing as I cried myself to sleep. I got banana and watermelon and peaches by the pound, sweet corn, Burlington, more better than in town. I got okra It's enough to choke you, beans of every kind. If hungry is what's eating you, I'll sell you peace of mind. Oh, but this ain't what you came to hear me say. And I hate to disappoint you, but I got no love today. I got no love today. I got no love today. No love today. I could not love to save myself from lonesome desperation. Everything I thought was love was worthless imitation. And my concept of commitment was to take all you could give. I thought the cheapest thrills I loved were teaching me to live.
Good morning. Well, good morning. Yes, it's still morning, and you are still listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and today we're talking about street food, really, or a taste and a growing taste for better food in the urban fabric of the streets. And we're talking with David Weber, who is president of the New York City Food Truck Association and also a founder of Rickshaw Dumpling Bar, and Melina Shannon DiPietro, who is the director of Food on the High Line, the raised public park that spans three neighborhoods on the west side of Manhattan. We have a question that actually pertains to the next topic that I was interested in getting to, and that is, we're talking about elevating this the food experience sort of on, literally on the street level, and everyone knows that in the kind of current ethos of the good food revolution, we're talking about local food and sustainable food and seasonal food. And yet here we are in a city in the Northeast where winters can be long, although this one seems like it's never coming. But and the seasonality of eating outside just seems fraught with a lot of things. So could you speak a little bit to the relationship between the season in both of these places, the traffic, but also the food served and the business model that can support such a diverse, what I imagine, business season. Both of you. Let's go to Shannon first. Let's go to Melina first.
Sure. Well, visitorship on the High Line changes dramatically in the different seasons. We're finding right now with the great weekends, weather is still busy, or the High Line is still busy. One thing that our food vendors do is change what they're serving across the season. So during the peak of the summer months, what you really wanted was cold ice cream, right, or a good popsicle. So People's Pops had these amazing watermelon popsicles, or La New Yorkina had great cucumber and citrus popsicles out, and that was really what people wanted. Days like this, of course, while there are a few hearty souls that still want an ice cream sandwich from Melt Bakery, I think most people are looking for something warm. And so our vendors, we've narrowed the number of vendors at this point. We have about a quarter of the number of vendors we have during the summer months. And they've also changed over their menu. So it's heartier, warmer foods for
and
people
so
to enjoy.
I guess perhaps for David, what happens to those vendors who have a business in the summer and don't in the winter?
Some vendors run seasonal businesses and literally, as part of their business model, close every winter. Or they might move cities. They might move to Miami or to a warmer climate if they serve something that's extremely cold. but seasonality is a very, very important aspect to street vending. The weather, the seasons, even parking all have a huge impact on what types of revenue can be generated any particular day. And there's definitely a change in the menu mix season by season, and that has to do with what's available and probably more importantly, what customers want. So we see the same thing on the streets as we do in the parks, where there's much, much more emphasis on cold food that's ready to go, ice cream treats in the summer, and in the winter, warmer foods, soups, schnitzel, that do really well in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to add that, I mean, we think about this a lot, both David and I, from the consumer side, what it is that we want to eat. But this is also an agricultural transition.
Right.
And there's something magical about the High Line itself in that the plantings are very seasonal. So like you would see on a farm, you're seeing the scope of an agricultural landscape, here a planted botanical landscape, in how it changes over the course of the seasons.
Right.
So you can also think about that as a connection to the environment
so
as well.
I think we should explain that a little bit more, and that one of the startlingly beautiful things about the High Line is the landscaping, which looks as though in some places it just sprouted up over the years, but actually has been very carefully curated and is part of the experience, that sort of special time.
Absolutely. It's a wild urban look, I call it. Pete Udoff, who was an incredible landscape designer, worked with James Corner Field Operations and Diller Scofidio Renfro, our team of designers. But it really,
and James Beard Award winners, actually, Diller Scofidio.
There you go. All good people. Yeah. But what they did with this landscape is create a landscape where you can feel the urban and the natural world coming together. There's a great planking system where literally you can see the planks and nature sort of clawing into one another. And Pete's idea in choosing the plants was that plants should reflect beauty throughout the season, that there's something beautiful in all four seasons. And I think we can see that in the food on the High Line and also on the streets as well.
Are there other parks? It's hard to remember sometimes. It's a public park, the High Line, that take food as seriously, or even that take the interaction of the community with the park as seriously? I'm thinking, for me, you know, the Shake Shack, which once was a little shack, was basically a cart and is now a phenomenon that's taking over the world, sort of was part of the rejuvenation of Madison Square Park. But are there other places that actually have integrated or that you've become a model for in the city?
Well, we're still very new at this work. Our team just began our work this season, and we're lucky to be in a city where I think there's been incredible food leadership from Mayor Bloomberg, from Speaker Quinn, and from the City Council, as well as the Manhattan Borough Presidents. And we have a lot of work to do as we go forward. I think the principles we've laid out, I hope, can be useful to other groups, that the food should elevate the experience, that it should be
literally and figuratively.
Literally, right? And
25
figuratively.
Feet, I now know, right?
That it should be sourced locally and sustainably, and that food should be kept affordable in price, because parks, of course, are democratic spaces, and we want everyone to feel welcome in those spaces.
Great. I'll remind listeners, you can still call in 718-497-2128 or write in your questions to info@heritageradionetwork.com. David, I've been to a lot of cities where street food is a sort of integral part of the urban experience, as similar to New York as Portland, Oregon, of course, which has sort of got this amazing food truck culture, but also as unique as perhaps Japan, Tokyo in Japan, where there's a whole different manner, a whole different way of socially interacting around food on the street. Some of the restaurants even are literally on the street. Are there other places that are models for you or that have informed New York, which seems to be coming, you might say, a little late to this street party, this food party?
What's really interesting is what you saw, I guess, maybe as far back as 2007 was really the rise of food trucks in New York, but it hasn't grown as quickly here as it has in other markets due to some of the regulatory constraints. Mm-hmm. Two of the big challenges for food trucks in New York City is, one, parking is quite hard, and especially this year with the advent of a no vendor of merchandise for meter parking and the change in the interpretation of merchandise to include food, so that food trucks are prohibited from vending from meter parking.
So, and that's in the legislative level. There's been a policy change?
It was a lawsuit that was brought against the city by the Patty's Taco Truck and the Street Vendor Project that, unfortunately, what became of it was a decision by the judge that food constitutes merchandise, which is something that we don't agree with, insofar as merchandise is commonly understood to be a commodity that's both bought and sold. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's something about food, there's a reason that hospitality is called a service industry, mm-hmm. that when you get a taco made to order with hot sauce and avocado, that it's a service, and it's made to order, and it's not resold. So in addition to the no vending for meter parking, the licensing process for employees is quite onerous in New York City. It takes 6 to 8 weeks to get a new employee able to vend on a truck, and employees without those licenses can be fined $1,000, and it's also a criminal offense, and they can be taken off a truck in handcuffs.
Wow. That's a dramatic part of your meal.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So there's some big challenges. And so what we see right now in New York City, I'd say there's maybe 75, 80 branded food trucks as compared with LA, which has about 400 trucks now, even Austin, which really saw the rise after New York, having about 250 trucks. So there's a lot more diversity in other markets. And one of the things we hope the city will do is ease off on the permitting constraints and let the market sort of run its course so it comes to a natural equilibrium in the number of trucks that should be out on the streets.
What about this phenomenon that I think of when I think of Portland, Oregon, also about parking lots or what seem to be sort of semi-permanent places for trucks and with communal seating areas? Is that something that's come to New York? Smorgasburg, I guess, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that probably the best and most successful example of that was the lot at the end of the High Line, which was run this summer by Melina and her team. We've been trying to recreate that, and that's one of the things we're hoping to do is create a network of lots on private space or you know, on public space through the Parks Department throughout the city, so that there's it's sort of an ancillary vending system that's going to run in tandem with the street permits that are available through the city to create, you know, this private network of lots. And in addition to the High Line lot, which we had this summer, we also set up a lot in Long Island City. And we're working with the city on two other lots and with private developers on three other lots throughout the city. So we're hoping for spring of 2012 that'll be a great system that'll contribute a lot to the culture of street food in New York City.
Great. I mean, my last question in the few moments we have left is about something about this particular moment and the rise in this culture of eating in public, and it has to do with technology. And part of the phenomenon seems to us at the Beard Foundation, where we follow all of these trucks on Twitter, and where there's this whole community beyond just what's on the corner or what's near, and how that has played into both of these places. If there's any, you know, if this could have happened before everyone had a smartphone or before there was a way to interact beyond passersby. Any thoughts about that?
You know, what I think is interesting is that the technology is becoming a way to feed community around food. When I look at the people following Rickshaw Dumplings or who came to the lot on tap this summer, they were building a community around food. This fall, we laid a long table on the High Line and set a lunch table for 200 people. But what we heard from people was the food was delicious. But what they were there for was to connect with the other people.
Absolutely. I think that the rise of Twitter and Facebook really laid a foundation that allows these trucks to move through space and time and connect with followers in different neighborhoods as they're moving. One of the things we always say is that restaurants have customers, but food trucks have followers or fans. And I think that there's a much more visceral connection between a food truck fan and the food truck itself. And I think that part of that is definitely the technology and the connection and the fact that the Twitter feeds are filled with content that is relevant, like where will that food truck be? But also the transparency of food trucks and the ability to see the entire process of the creation of the food, and also see the impact that a $5 transaction is having on the livelihood of the entrepreneur.
Right. And speaking of fans, in the last seconds we have the Vendy Awards come to mind, that the Street Vendor Project actually elects or chooses. I don't know how they do it in particular on Governor's Island every year. It's just become this huge event among all of my friends, foodie or otherwise. You just get on the ferry and go eat yourself sick at this giant party. And so there really is a support from the community and also from the food world and from the municipal life of New York City that I think in all of the cities where street eating is really important, that just makes it more fun and delicious to be a citizen. That's why we're here to talk about taste. You're listening to Taste Matters every Wednesday at 11 o'clock. We'll have a conversation for 30 minutes with some interesting people and some interesting aspects about the food that we eat and why taste is important. Next week, we'll be talking to Clark Wolf, who is a restaurant consultant and a sort of man about food. And he's going to talk to us about trends and about pairings and about all sorts of things, taste and food related. He's a character and a half, and you should listen. You can also find these shows as podcasts on iTunes, where we were one of the new and noteworthy shows. And please come back to heritageradionetwork.com and listen to all of the other wonderful programs on this station. Thanks, Melina. Thank you, David. And we should go hit the streets for lunch.
Thank you. 3時間も待っていたのよ私猫と一緒に
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a message from Jones Family Farms. Looking for that perfect Christmas tree this season? What about the perfect wine to go with your holiday dinner? Look no further than Jones Family Farm, a 400-acre working farm in Connecticut. Jones Family Farms is as passionate about education as it is about farming. Whether you're picking fresh strawberries or exploring local wines, we hope you're inspired to learn more about Connecticut farming. For more information, visit www.jonesfamilyfarms.com. This is a message from Vegan Pop-Up Shop. Looking for the perfect holiday gift for that special vegan in your life? Come down to the Vegan Holiday Shop-Up Sunday, December 4th from 12 to 5 p.m. at the Pine Box Rock Shop in Bushwick. There you'll find a wide array of vegan-friendly treats, eats, fashions, and home goods. From soy wax candles to homemade hot sauce, the Vegan Holiday Shop-Up has your vegan present needs covered. So come down early and stay late and enjoy a spicy Bloody Mary while you're there, and maybe leave with something extra for yourself.